This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
And welcome to The Greg Tucker Show. And it is Tuesday.
Thank you, Truman.
Well, it is your show, you know. And Greg should be doing this commercial because he and I do like the same places. And we would like to talk to you about at-home care.
Well, that would be good.
Yes, Melissa Warren's business. And everyone knows by now that they go into your home 24/7. And that takes care of all the duties that has to be done in your home, including errands. And you can sit back and enjoy life like you were meant to. And if that sounds good to you, give them a call at 713-4639, or you can pull them up on the internet, www.athomecaretennessee.com, and I'll guarantee you, you'll be glad you called. You know, it's always fun. Now, you and I are kind of like Abbott and Costello and Lewis and Martin and some of the great acts over the years. And you're also like a producer and promoter because you have given me a lot of great names for this show. Over a lot of guests that have come on have been people that you have recommended. And I had three really great ones last week. Including this week, too.
Got them all on in the same week.
Yeah, sure did.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had so many compliments on them. Like we had Dennis on yesterday.
The organ builder.
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, milling our organs in Eagleville. And I think we covered maybe 1% of what we wanted to talk to him about because he was so fascinated. And then, of course, we had Ellen Buckner on who is just really a true artist. I mean, she really is.
I think very few people realize that we actually have opera-type singers mm-hmm. with international experience in this neighborhood.
Which you and your family have been very interested in over the years, especially the missus.
That's right.
and she's very much a part of it. And then, of course, we had Norris, who is a tremendous artist.
I mean, he's world class.
Yeah,
he really is. People again perhaps don't realize that we have artists of that caliber with that kind of success. I mean, in Europe, as well known in Europe. And I always, when I mention Norris to somebody, I say the license plate with the fish on it. It's one of his. In fact, that may be you may have learned that may be kind of his trademark is the fish. Fish art.
It is, but I was interested in so many other things that he had, like the clocks that he has, that he can do a logo for anybody. It doesn't matter what kind of business, and it stands out. But part of what you do in some of the places that you learn, you go to Hooper Supply quite a bit, and you run into quite a few characters over there.
There are about 36 regulars, and if they all show up on the same day, it can be very crowded. Usually there's a dozen or so that come in there every day about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and mm-hmm. for an hour to an hour and a half, you can bring up almost any subject that can come to mind, and someone there will tell you about it, mm-hmm. and someone else there will argue about the details. And I do. I learn a lot about things in general, but also, you know, from time to time, I'll go in there with a puzzle that I'm trying to figure out in our local history, mm-hmm. and very often get help. I'm actually, most of the time, I'm the youngest one in the group. So you can see I've got a lot of people to learn from there.
Now, how does a person like me get to be a member of the Hooper Bunch?
If you like coffee and you got an hour and a half in the morning.
Do they have cream and sugar?
Oh, yeah, cream and sugar. I always have a little coffee with my cream.
Yeah.
Other guys go the other way. And very recently, we've had Jerry Warner and Abby Miller join the groups. Kind of new to the group, but, you know, they've got a lot of background, a lot of interesting stories. Jerry was a school teacher for longer than I've been on Earth. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Abby Miller was in the insurance business and many other things around that for many, many years. Miller and Lowry, now part of Pinnacle Bank, but still...
Right.
Still going. Eddie Miller, his son. We figured out we were third cousins not long ago.
Of course.
Yeah, as part of what's fun about the older families. I wrote an article where I mentioned J.P. Leathers, probably the most successful politician of 1900, 1950, that period. Was county court clerk for 30-odd years. And next time I saw Eddie, he says, well, you know, I'm related to J.P. And it turns out that his great-grandfather and my great-grandmother were brothers and sisters.
Wow.
We had never noticed that before. But, in fact, we sat down, pencil and paper, and kind of plotted it out to be sure.
I can see where you would be related to the Now, what relation was J.P. to Walter? The Rockville
Yeah, they are related, and I can't tell you the exact, but J.P.'s family was down around the Midland area.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back another generation, you'd probably find where they come together. Mm-hmm. But I know the families are related.
You were talking before we came on, and I don't know why, it just hit me that the building that's right there at Hooper Supply, that has been in the metal business so long.
Across the street, 100 years ago, was a blacksmith shop. And that blacksmith shop evolved into a metal fabrication shop. Mm-hmm. And has continued in that line of business through, I don't know how many different owners, but different owners, different names, but mm-hmm. always the same line of business. And I'd say just the last few months of last year, it closed down and now is inactive. The building's available. It'd be nice if another metal fabricator would pick up the business, because I'm sure there's equipment and such there to that. But kind of a passing of an era. It used to be almost any town of any size would have somebody. Well, originally they'd have a lot of blacksmiths, but they'd have a metal fabrication shop where the plows and the pieces, whatever it might be, would be made. And we're talking about not tool and die where they're cut and shaped, where they were really casting, from the raw ingots. I think we very likely have seen the end of that type business in Rutherford County. And not unexpected. So much of that's gone overseas, and so much of the demand has changed that it'd probably be a tough business to handle right now.
You know, change can be good, but you also lose a lot with change. And one of the things that I really was interested in talking to Dennis yesterday was that his particular craft is still needed. And I guess one of the biggest reasons is that there are a lot of organs in this area and, of course, across the nation, the pipe organs that were built by hand, by real artists, and there's still a great need to keep them functional and keep them in good shape. So, I mean, he and his son, I mean, his sons are going to be passed on that business. And as far as I could tell, as long as you have something that's available like that, there shouldn't be no end, actually, to that business.
Well, you get me in my mode of giving advice, but, young people today, people coming right out of high school, there's so much almost social pressure that everybody has to go to college, and everybody's got to get the degree, and then they get out of college, and they look around, and what am I doing now with my. I think if I had children again, I would be encouraging them, particularly those that seem to enjoy doing things with their hands, to look for these skills that you know are going to be around for a good while yet. And get, because listening to Dennis yesterday, he had gotten some skill in tool and die when he was 16, 17 years old, and then was able to apply that, and now has a very, very successful regional business that's going to support his next generation as well as him in good style. And he dropped out of high school.
Mm-hmm. And when he was 14, I think.
Yeah, but they learned a trade.
Right.
And I think that's so true today. We have trouble finding sometimes people. We rely on immigrants because others don't have the skill or don't have the interest in a lot of the building trades, for example. But try to get a watch repaired right now, yeah. or an old mechanical clock. Mm-hmm. You know, the people are disappearing that can do that. And as long as we've got at least hobbyists and collectors, you know there's going to be a demand for those kind of skills.
It makes you wonder, the way that education is going, the direction that it's going right now, it doesn't seem to be really practical, because just like with Dennis, he went in a direction that was going to be something he really enjoyed. It really worked well with his personality and his talents. So therefore, he's been able to bring it to bear. Well, it seems like right now we're almost cookie-cutting education, mm-hmm. and aiming them in an area that they're really not going to be successful with, utilizing all the education that they've been able to bring with them.
Of late, there's been a lot of publicity. It's probably be a campaign issue about the need for more engineers. And I would take that short of engineers. We need more people who are technicians that mm-hmm. are willing to do the technical skills and enjoy it. And yes, the engineer may design the ship, but you need some skilled welders to put it together. And I think there are still places you can learn those skills, but instead of directing everybody to college, I think we should be directing them into these other areas and identifying those interests and those abilities early, mm-hmm. and doing that. We're getting a little philosophical here, aren't we?
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong
show.
With that. Let me
You're kind of philosophical in your way.
Am I?
Yeah.
I'll take that as a compliment.
It is.
Let me backtrack. Last time we were on, we were talking about the World War II, the mm-hmm. Second Army maneuvers, and the impact right. it had on the community. And in particular, we talked about some of the sad parts of that. Mm-hmm. In particular, there was one child that we knew from the military records was killed, hit by a vehicle, actually getting out of a van coming from Vacation Bible School, mm-hmm. A 9-year-old girl. Since then, with the help of some of our listeners and readers, we've identified another in a tragic situation that occurred almost the same time, which for some reason, and this was what made me particularly curious, is not addressed in the military records, at least the records we've been able to review, which were very detailed on mm-hmm. all the other deaths. But a 4-year-old boy named Drury, not a common name today, D-R-U-R-Y, Drury Lee Jordan, at 4 years old, was hit and instantly killed, according to the news report, by a half-track out on Las Casas Highway, or one of the streets, roads just off Las Casas Highway. And he was the younger brother of some of the Jordans that still live in the area.
Mm.
And the way we confirmed it was one of our listeners directed us to the tombstone, and mm-hmm. it had the date of the death. And sure enough, in the Daily News Journal for October 12th, 1943, headline, Child Killed Instantly by Army Vehicle.
Wow.
And it notes in there that an Army investigation of the incident was pending. But again, we found no record. I'm going to continue looking and see if we can find any record of that investigation. But, you know, that was a curious time, I guess you'd say, mm-hmm. and an awful lot of suffering, an awful lot of sacrifice during that period. And you can imagine, I heard someone say, boy, if I'd been the driver of that half track, I think I'd have had to gone straight to the VA. I don't believe I could have handled that, killing a child in that circumstance.
You know, it really is important, because we have a large group of listeners out there, and a lot of them have information that we haven't come across, and even you haven't come across, and that's the main thing. And we would love to share some of that information if you just let us know some of the, especially the interesting things that have gone on in the history of Murfreesboro, because it's an unending book out there, mm-hmm. and there's no way that we could ever read all the pages. But if they just call attention and let you know,
Well, some of the more interesting points that I've learned come after I've written an article or after we've discussed something, and I'll get a call or an email or someone stop me with a point. And that's one reason I enjoy doing a book every couple of years, because that gives me a chance to republish or include what's been in the newspaper, but then to add to it these other points and other interesting things. And the one we were just talking about would be a good example of that. And hopefully we, by the time we put out another book, we'll be able to run down the military investigation and see just what the details were. Speaking of details, we're still celebrating the bicentennial of Murfreesboro.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to keep that in people's minds, because if you go back 200 years ago today, they still didn't know where Murfreesboro was going to be.
Hmm.
In fact, in January 200 years ago, the individuals who were appointed by the state legislature to pick a site for Murfreesboro, and were told that it was going to be named Murfreesboro no matter where you put it,
mm-hmm.
they were in January just appearing before the Commissioner Nash, who was the equivalent of the county judge.
Mm-hmm.
Today we call it county mayor. Back then, a very wealthy landowner in his own right. They appeared before him and had to post bond, because part of their duties included first selecting a site,
mm-hmm.
but then they were supposed to divide it and sell it off after purchasing it or getting it as a gift, however it worked out. So they were going to be handling a great deal of money, and they were required to, each one of them, post a bond of $4,000 each, which back then was a princely sum.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious how each of these would have the ability to make that kind of bond. Well, it turns out that each of those town commissioners, again, was a major landowner. And what they did was they signed indentures, essentially pledging their assets mm-hmm. on their good intentions and their good faith in performing their duties. So each one of them signed an indenture for $4,000, and then they were free to go about what they had been charged with doing. With the understanding that, you know, if you fail or if in any way, there's any misdoings, we've got you and everything you own up to $4,000. Again, would have bought a nice farm back then,
mm-hmm.
That amount of money.
That was a big investment for them.
That was a big risk.
Mm-hmm. And investment.
Yeah. Investment and risk. And
yeah.
It was just in January that they put up the bond. So, you know, we go back to when we kicked off our bicentennial celebration was October. Well, October is when the legislature said, okay, we're going to find a new county seat. In November, they told us finally what we were going to name it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time period, they selected the seven, we call them now town commissioners, mm-hmm. new town commissioners. And finally, in January, they began their work. And next month we can talk about how they got inundated with proposals and solicitations and what you might expect from all those around the county that had a vested interest in where this new town was going to be set. But we'll save that till February.
Yeah, that was the main point of everything right then, because they had an idea that's where everything was going to be the central location of businesses and everything else, and they knew that it was going to grow. So,
and it had already been established once only mm-hmm. 6 years before, and that meant they were going to uproot literally an awful lot of business and investment, or how would you say, they're going to devalue it, because once the seat of justice moved, then an awful lot of commercial activity would move with
mm-hmm.
it. Certainly all the lawyers would move.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, people who had business with the county in its official capacity and traveled to a location to do that business would also do their shopping and their other activity there. So, and it's interesting, and again, we overlook when we just talk about it as you know, our history, but it didn't get through the legislature. First off, there was some powerful lobbying, but even when it finally came up to a final vote, there was a strong dissent And if you read the dissent, it was saying, in fact, it's not fair for us to have let people make this kind of an investment in a place that was designated as the county seat and then take it away from them, pull it away from them. I thought...
That's a good point.
Yeah. And it also was unprecedented. I haven't studied very closely, but I doubt that anything quite like that happened again anywhere else in the state. But there were some very powerful landed interests that wanted to move the county seat. And they did have some argument. And after it took them about 3 or 4 years of lobbying to get the decision in their favor that there would be a new county seat. And then recently when I was speaking to a group about this, I said there were four big fights. The first one was whether or not there's going to be a new county seat. The second one was where it's going to be. The third one was the fight over the title of the property. And then finally, Jefferson interest said, we're not moving. We're not moving. And it took a while before they could get a majority vote of the county commissioners at that time to move.
How did that affect the Jefferson community with the county seat moving from there to Murfreesboro?
It went into quick decline. It continued as a town of some significance for probably the end of the 1800s. Because of its convenient transportation location, it was still on the river, and it had called the Port of Jefferson. And from there, it was easy to load and get on down to Nashville. But just the immediate impact was, there. For instance, one family named Jetton, looks like Jetton. I've heard
Jetton,
it pronounced
we've Jetton. Already called it. Yeah,
it was one of the first stores of consequence up in Jefferson. He shut down and moved and came down to Murfreesboro. And as we've talked before, one of the more prominent names in the early history. But there was a lot of that. So, Jefferson's fate was sealed when the legislature said, we're moving. And even though they fought it, you read some of the minutes of the meetings in that period. Despite the fact that a new site had been selected as late as June of 1813, the commissioners are still voting to remodel the jail in Jefferson, the county jail, although they knew at the time that a new jail was being built. They just were hanging on, as best they could. But ultimately, the state legislature controls, and the decision had been made. But still, it was... I think it was January 1813 or 14 when finally they got a majority vote, and the next meeting was in the new Murfreesboro as opposed to Jefferson where they had been meeting.
You think about it, how fragile everything was at that time, and the few families that put up pretty much their whole life savings and what they had earned. If the vote had gone the other way, Jefferson would probably be thriving right now.
I'm sure of that.
And Rutherford County, not Rutherford County, but Murfreesboro, would have had probably the same type fate.
Well, there never would have been a Murfreesboro. If the Jefferson interest had prevailed initially in the legislature, the county seat would have stayed right where it was, and probably there never would have been a Murfreesboro. I'm sure... other areas would have developed upriver, there would not have been a Murfreesboro because even the name came after the decision to make a new county seat. And I have said several times that the Murfree family was so powerful after the death of the Colonel, Hardy Murfree, in the land they owned, not only in this area, but across the mid-state. I have heard something in the neighborhood of 70,000 acres they controlled.
Wow.
And so, when it came to the state legislature, they had an awful lot of leverage.
Still a very well-known family here, the Murfrees.
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. But we were talking about the location, And the west side of what was what became the original Murfreesboro was the Archibald Lytle original Revolutionary Grant, mm-hmm. the west border. But from the corner of his property all the way around, three sides was owned by the Murfree family. The Lytle family controlled the north side for what we now would call several city blocks. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it was the Murfree property.
Sometimes if you kind of work together, things can work out a little bit more in your favor, and we can even go to the capital of Tennessee. It ended up in Nashville, of course,
right.
But we had a really great opportunity
yeah.
to maintain the capital here.
Yeah, and we've talked about that. If the local administration had been willing to put up the money to move the books, and that's really what it was, the library and the records.
Something that simple.
Yeah, and it sounds like a petty amount, but $100 back then was fairly significant, and it was no more than a couple of $100 to do mm-hmm. that. And then the governor said he didn't want to move his office, but the legislature controlled the location of the Capitol, so it still could have happened if they had gotten together on it.
Well, you think of how things flow, and nothing stays the same. I mean, what we're seeing right now, probably most everything's going to change 50 years from now. Yeah. We won't even be able to recognize
right.
what's going on.
Well, your last point, and I think that's one of the best lessons we can get from our bicentennial history, and that is those people who were at odds at the first stage and those people who were allies. The allies then became the opponents mm-hmm. because the interest shifted. And then after that was worked out and the site was chosen, the allies again turned out in opposition because there was differences as to whose property was going to be used for mm-hmm. what. So like they say, politics, makes for strange bedfellows. You never know who's going to be in bed with you next time.
Yeah, yeah.
And can be very different from the last issue.
Well, don't make too many enemies, because they'll be your friends in another year
That's
or two.
Right.
It's just basically what it goes.
And
you just have to work a little harder.
And watch your friends, because they may have a different interest tomorrow.
Exactly. Human nature. And we want to let you know that this part of the show is brought to you by Pirtle and Howerton Automotive. And if you're looking for a Ford, Mercury, Chevrolet, Buick, or GMC, take about a 20-25 minute drive into Bedford County on 231 South, just before you get into Shebaville. It's on your left, and that's Mark Pearl and John Howerton's business. And let me tell you, you can't deal with nicer people. And they have staff on hand that can answer all the questions that you need answering, and will show you their great lineup out there in the lot. And you can also call them at 1-800-264-6800, toll free, or pull them up on the internet, PirtleHowerton.com.
Southeastern Tire of Murfreesboro has the right tires for your vehicle. Perhaps you're a rugged individual who enjoys off-roading. They have a tire for you. Or maybe you're a rap star driving around on 26-inch rims. They have a tire for that. You're a mom who's in the carpool lane daily. They have a tire for your minivan. Let's say you're a wealthy trial lawyer who drives a Lamborghini. Yes, they have a tire for you too. Maybe you drive one of those new electric vehicles. Hey, they have a tire for you. Southeastern Tire Service has a tire for every personality. They're on Broad Street, a tire or two away from Chevy of Murfreesboro.
Hello, this is Truman Jones. We have a new sponsor, and one that you're going to be delighted with. It's National Healthcare, National Healthcare Corporation, right here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And this is where life is celebrated. Discover a different kind of care, one that ensures that you're surrounded by people who make a difference in your life. In 11 states, patients and residents feel right at home at National Healthcare Corporation's more than 130 affiliated healthcare centers and home care offices. Their family of facilities delivers exceptional rehabilitative skilled nursing and extended care in locations that are close to home and family. In line with their longtime commitment to provide a continuum of care to those who need their services at any age. And want to let you know that this is a local business started here, even though it's pretty much all through the Southeast. National Healthcare, Murfreesboro, where life is celebrated.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by the Omni Hut Restaurant in Smyrna, AmeriCare Pest Control, and the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS.
I've got pests.
AmeriCare is Rutherford County's number one choice in pest control, and it's simple to see why. After calling 893-7111, their staff came to my house 8 years ago when I had an insect problem. They looked at the situation, showed me the areas, and what they'd recommend to resolve the problem. After treatment and with quarterly checks, I'm bug, critter, and creepy crawly free. Thanks, AmeriCare.
Call the best of the best to get rid of your pest.
AmeriCare, 893-7111.
Now, Good Neighbor Events. You can purchase passes at both SportsCom and the Patterson Community Center for 25% off now through January the 31st. Don't let this one slip away. And the Greenhouse Ministries is offering free income tax preparation if your household income is less than $50,000 annually. They're also looking for volunteers to help them with that project. Call the Greenhouse Ministries at 494-0499. And the Master Gardeners of Rutherford County are accepting registrations for a limited number of seats in their annual Garden Basics class. It's almost full, so you need to get with the Lane Agripark quickly. Call them at 898-7710. The class is on Monday evenings from 6 to 9 and begins January the 23rd. You need to call the local Heart of Tennessee chapter of the Red Cross and ask about their CPR and first aid classes. They also have a few openings in their babysitter's training class. The local Red Cross is at 501 Memorial Boulevard, a former Chamber of Commerce location. Remember to get your Good Neighbor Events to WGNS at least 2 weeks before they occur.
Weather Eye.
Mainly cloudy this afternoon, chance of seeing some light rain. High and low 60s. Tonight, mainly cloudy with showers and isolated thunderstorms. A low near 50. I'm WGNS meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Right now, it's 50 degrees.
Smoked wings, barbecue, the redneck nachos, you know what I'm talking about. It's Kirk and Burt Smokehouse Grill on Kaysen Lane. Stop on in. Each day, they've got great specials for you. Kirk and Burt Smokehouse Grill on Kaysen Lane here in Murfreesboro.
Now more of The Truman Show with Truman Jones on WGNS AM and FM.
With today's guest, Mr. Greg Tucker.
And, of course, Brian is wrong. He said, guest, this is your show. And I don't know why he keeps messing up on that.
Welcome back to The Greg Tucker Show with Truman Jones.
Yes, all right. I like that.
Okay. I have no comment.
And we would both like for you to know that this portion of the show is brought to you by Gold and Coin Connection. And they're at 2568 South Church Street, right there beside Gateway Tire Center. And the owners are Pastor Larry Dunn of ERO Ministries, Chris Chico, and Wayne Everly. And they buy scrap gold, jewelry, platinum, coins, and silverware. They have vintage sports collectibles and even some great antiques. For a fair and honest evaluation of your collectibles, take them by and see Pastor Larry Dunn and his partners today. And that's at the Gold and Coin Connection at 2568 South Church Street, or give them a call at 890-2646. You know, we can go in all kinds of directions, and we always do. And one of the things I really found interesting in the paper Sunday was how the schools have changed and evolved. And most of these schools, their structures and everything, are non-existent now. But yet, they were the center of their communities. And such odd names.
That's true. Part of the fun of the story was just the odd names and how they came to be and what happened to them, where they were. But like we were talking before the break, the things that can be learned from our history, other than just, you know, what happened and who was involved or where it was, as we were talking about in our bicentennial, originally the people that were fighting against each other then became allies and then became again antagonists, as you know, the different steps in the decision process. The schools reflect some of that, but also the schools indicate to us how our society was changing. You know, some people think of, well, you know, the county school system came about much later. Well, no, actually the very first formal school that we can identify was a county school. Back in about 1803, the federal government set up a plan, sounds like some of our funding programs now, that essentially said that from the territorial property, certain properties would be set aside to fund education if the states would move quickly to. So in 1806, the Tennessee legislature identified an academy, and at that time the word academy meant that it had public funding. They had designated an academy in every existing county at the time. It was 1806. And then, and I've seen on one map, it's hard to define, but on one map I've seen the academy lands that were set aside, not to build a school on, but to be productive, and then the funds generated there. Sounds like what came along later at the college level, the land grant institutions, they call them. And the school that was designated in 1806 was called Bradley Academy. And, of course, we were just talking about dates. In 1806, the center of this county was Jefferson, that area. And the state legislature named a half dozen individuals of prominence to found that school in Rutherford County. And about 3 years later, in 1809, going through old newspapers in Nashville, I found the first announcement that Bradley Academy was opening, that the teacher was going to be Mr. Black. And it was located about 2 miles due east of Jefferson along what we now call the road that runs along just south of the East Fork of the river. Central Valley. Sorry, I blocked on that.
I was staying on Central Pike, and I knew that wasn't right.
Well, actually, back then, it was the Jefferson to Readville roadway. It was the main route through the county at the time. And that became Bradley Academy. Now, some people have speculated, some history writers in the area have speculated that Bradley Academy was named for some people who owned a very substantial piece of land up there. I have not found anything that ties the Bradley family that were the landowners to the academy, which is a bit of a surprise. The Bradleys were not part of the founding group. They were not ever involved in the education. So it's still, I think, a mystery exactly why it was named Bradley Academy. But then, showing how you were talking about how Jefferson lost when Murfreesboro came about, Murfreesboro is finally sited and begins to grow in 1812. Well, the powers that were able to get the legislature to move the county seat apparently went back to the legislature and got all of the board members, we'd call them today, for Bradley Academy reappointed. And the new ones were all from the Murfreesboro area, the new town area. So by 1813, they moved Bradley Academy. They took it out of the Jefferson area and brought it down. The Episcopal Church on East Main was the original site. You can't find deed records for it because it wasn't purchased. It was loaned to them, probably by one of the Murphys at the time. That became Bradley Academy, and that's why Academy Street, which was originally East Street, was quickly renamed Academy Street because you had Bradley there. That was a county school, county supported. Now, those who went there paid part of it, but it had the county subsidy through the original system that was set up with the land. Interestingly enough, it failed within 3 years and shut down, which took the county out of county school education.
Was that for lack of instructors or people?
Well, they still had, Black came down with the school, and they picked up, I believe his name was Henderson. He was the Presbyterian preacher and had one of the early little private country schools. And the two of them taught for a while, and then Black went back to the Jefferson area and opened his own private school.
That's what I was going to ask you. What happened to the school and the students there?
Henderson, after a while, left. The school collapsed in that interim, James K. Polk had been a student, mm-hmm. which of course brought it to some fame. Mm-hmm. But by 1818, the school had closed again. It reopened a third, that would have been in a third location, which I think was probably what we today would call a bootleg kind of operation, because it was without any of the legislative direction. Mm-hmm. And then was opened a fourth time and ended up in what we now think of as the Bradley Academy site. Mm-hmm. And then it was again funded and affiliated with the state and the county. But on that occasion, they outlawed lotteries. And the lottery had become a primary way of funding for an institution such as a county academy. They outlawed those. And apparently the land at the time that had been set aside to generate support for the school was not sufficient. And by 1840, it had virtually disappeared again. In fact, in 1842, all the property was turned over to what became Union University. So it took the county out of the business. So what filled the gap was a number of private institutions. And you look at a map of old Murfreesboro, you'll see such and such institute, the Female Institute, mm-hmm. Soul, things of this sort, mm-hmm. which were focused more on higher education. But what during that period, which would be about beginning 1820s forward, what we call subscription schools. And that is a young fellow come into the community with a little bit of an education, and he would essentially go from farm to farm selling subscriptions to the school. And the families would pay a certain amount, maybe a dollar or so a year, mm-hmm. So their child could attend his school. And these were called the subscription schools. And that's where we get the unusual names and for most of them, because these early schools frequently would take a name that described the environment. Or two of my favorites that we haven't written about yet were Hard Start mm-hmm. and Little Hope. Mm-hmm. You can see the thoughts. We did write about what I thought was particularly, I wish I had gone to a school named Seed Tick.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
And
they suck all the information out of the book, right?
It might be.
Yeah.
Well, a seed tick, to be technical, is the larva of the dog tick or the deer tick we mm-hmm. know. And, the earliest, how would you say, the earliest life stage of the tick mm-hmm. beyond the egg. And I speculate, and again, I can't point out anything that says this is the case, but I think Seed Tick was a popular name for a school because you were taking the young ones mm-hmm. and just beginning, as you say, to give them, imbue them with some knowledge, some information. Mm-hmm. So we had four schools around the county that I've been able to identify. All were called the Seed Tick schools. First one down around Fosterville, in the 1840s, and then there was two up in the northern part of the county, and all these were called Seed Tick schools or just Seed Tick. You see a similar thing with the Possum Trot schools. Mm-hmm. We had two schools named Possum Trot. Now you hear Possum Trot still today when someone talks about a remote, perhaps backward or isolated area of a region, or someone that you
kind of outside of Eagleville, back up in there.
Somewhere back up in there. Or if you're teasing someone about being from the country, you might mm-hmm. say, well, he's from Possum Trot, mm-hmm. so and so. These schools were in remote areas, because if I was a Baptist missionary with a little bit of education, read and write, and I wanted to set up a school to support me mm-hmm. and do some good, you'd go into the remote areas where mm-hmm. There are a dozen or so families, and find you a corner where you could get the locals to build a log cabin or whatever, and start your school. And that was a way to support yourself. And I also noticed something else which I think is interesting. If you were selecting a mate, mm-hmm. a wife, back in the 1800s, early 1800s. Obviously, there are those romantic considerations. Mm-hmm. But knowing what the lifestyle is, you wanted a good, healthy woman who could handle the chores and the pressures and the physical aspect of handling the woman's side of a farm, raising a family. In reading through our history, I found several where the school marm, the woman instructor, was handicapped.
Hmm.
In fact, one of them we identified, the one-armed pedagogue down towards the southern part of the county. And I can see these were mostly unmarried women who were looking for a way to support themselves and were smart and diligent enough to, you know, be literary, be educated, at least enough to teach reading and writing, the basics. And they frequently would be the leaders of the schools. And overcoming their handicap, which might prevent them from doing, you know, the physical labor on a farm, but, you know, would not affect their ability to teach and work with kids, things like that. You can see how things evolve.
Yeah, while you're going through that, it keeps running through my mind. What type of subjects did they have? I know they had to have math and probably language, but I was wondering what type of subjects they had at that time, how it related to the times. And, of course, one of the biggest things, just like we were talking about Dennis a few minutes ago, there were a lot of trades that were passed down from one family to another. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering how the schools affected the evolvement of those trades in has it been a positive or a negative thing when it comes down to something of that nature?
Well, I think you'd have to say, you know, the basic education is always a positive. But if you read of that period in the schools and such, one of the things the schools had to be careful not to do was to interfere with the almost survival routine of the farm families, the rural families. Sessions were scheduled so the kids would be available to help with the harvest or to help with the hog killing or to, you know, the planting time. And they were not teaching in, you know, on its face anything that you would really think is pertinent to farm life. Mm-hmm. What they were doing was trying to bring the children to the point of being literate, i.e. they could read and they could write enough to do what was necessary in connection with these real vocations, these real ways of living and making a living. And we've all heard of the three R's, but teaching reading and writing skills, when you talk to people who have some recollection back then or read some of the old interviews, the things they were reading frequently had no connection whatever to life as they knew it. They'd be reading the old classics and some of the Greek writings and such, but they were learning to read. And they would have writing exercises, learning to write, sign their name, and this kind of thing. And then what was not really called arithmetic back then, three R's, it was more ciphering, which meant how to handle numbers.
Yeah.
And that probably, if I was teaching it, I would count cows and count pigs and figure out, you know, the bill at the store as a practical matter to try to relate it. But those were the skills they were learning, not things that they would do to make a living, but things they would be able to do to protect themselves and to assure that what they did was productive.
Now, did the teachers back then, did they have degrees and diplomas, and did they have to have anything like that to teach? And did the students they receive any type of documentation that they had gone so far in school or whatever?
The subscription schools, they just had to be credible, because I want to set up a school in this area, I'd come into your home where I knew you had two or three children, and I would persuade you that I had enough background, education, or whatever. There was no requirement at all in these subscription schools. When the county, which was really after the Civil War, got into the business of education and essentially began to buy out and take over and crowd out the subscription schools, then they began to develop criteria that you had to be able to show that you had some kind of an educational history and background. subscription schools, though, frequently were the pastors, or, as I said, a young woman in the community that needed a way to make a living. And yes, I have seen documentation from the middle to the later 1800s where a private school would give a piece of paper of some kind. Mm-hmm. But that was not what was the, I'd say that would have been the exception in the early days, certainly not the rule. The kids weren't working for a diploma. They were trying to learn to read and write in between doing the chores back at home.
What if somebody wanted to be an attorney? Did you?
An attorney went to
did
another.
Did you just have a certain type of a personality?
Well, that was, we still talk about reading for the law. Yeah, someone who wanted to be an attorney went and found an attorney.
Yeah.
And went to work with him and read until he could claim to be an attorney.
And we want to let you know that the last part of the show is brought to you by Stan McNabb. And at Stan's, they provide quality vehicles from Chevrolet, Dodge, Jeep, Ford, and Cadillac to the Murfreesboro, McMinnville, and Shevel, Tennessee area. They have a large selection that ensures that they have a vehicle for everyone, no matter what it is you're looking for. And for a quality used car in Tullahoma, visit their dealership located at 2000 North Jackson Street. They have a large inventory of pre-owned cars, trucks, SUVs, and minivans to select from. And at Stan McNabb Automotive, they pride themselves in the quality that they offer on all of their used cars, which makes them a major destination for used vehicles. And only at Stan McNabb's can you get free oil changes and free tires for the life of that vehicle.
Murfreesboro Medical Clinic is more than just a clinic. It's the doctors you can trust, a technician you can believe in, and a staff member who goes the extra mile. From the time someone walks in our doors, the difference becomes evident. All of our resources are used to improve the healthcare experience of our patients, and we have been a part of Rutherford and surrounding counties for over 60 years. Murfreesboro Medical Clinic.
Murfreesboro Medical Clinic.
Did you get storm damage from the hail storm? If you're not familiar with the process, making an insurance claim due to the recent hail storm might seem confusing. Matthew H. from North Murfreesboro said, quote, Millennium Roofing has a certified insurance adjuster on staff. They insisted on being present when our adjuster examined our home. Now that's what I call service, end quote. Millennium Roofing is a local family-owned company and has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. Millennium Roofing and Construction, 525-6725 or millenniumroofingtn.com.
Slick Pig Barbecue. Down on East Main, there's pork, beef, chicken, and wings. Sauce too good to be true.
Now at Slick Pig Barbecue, try the catfish special. Wednesday night between 4 and 8 o'clock. $9.99 plus tax for all-you-can-eat catfish. The meal includes hush puppies, white beans, and homemade coleslaw.
Slick Pig Barbecue, 1920 East Main.
You've known him for years. Now you can visit with him every day. It's The Truman Show, continuing right now on WGNS, AM and FM.
And welcome back with Greg Tucker. And I don't know how long we've got. Brian's sitting over there with not showing me anything. But we'll just go as long as we want to. Do what?
15 seconds now.
15 seconds.
All right. Well, I'll give
what do you got, Greg?
15 seconds. A preview seconds. Real quick. If you enjoy the funny names or the unusual names of some of the old schools, we're going to go at it one more time with names like Sheep House, Hard Start, Lizard Lick, and Toenails.
I love all those.
I promise you every one of them was a school in Rutherford County.
I wonder what you learned at Toenails. That seems like an interesting. I believe that one specialized.
Well, they started at the bottom there.
Okay. Somehow, I really do hate to see this show go. You think we could go another hour, Brian?
What would we be displacing? Nothing important?
No, nothing important. I mean, just Brian.
No comment. Melissa's coming back. She's got the big stick.
Uh-oh. We'll have to leave then. You know, tomorrow... Greg, we've got Jimmy C. Newman on again.
Oh, I'm going to try online to see if I can get it. I'm going to be in Florida tomorrow.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Well, take your computer with you and make sure you're able to pick him up, because he has been down in Louisiana for the holidays.
Oh, my.
And he's back, and I think he's going to share some of the interesting things that they do during the holidays down there in Cajun country.
I love the way he puts on that Cajun accent. Or do you think that's for real?
I have never heard him say anything that wasn't Cajun. I think sometimes he has a hard time understanding me. I think he does. He goes down there and you get that different.
Well, your ear gets adjusted to a certain, yeah.
One of these days he's going to teach me how to catch an alligator. I can't wait to do that.
Yeah, lots of luck.
And he also has cut a new CD, so he's going to bring that with him, I hope. And tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we're going to have Jimmy C. Newman, the legend from the Grand Ole Opry, and one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. So, see you tomorrow at 2.
One of our neighbors.
And one of our neighbors.